Welcome to Money and Racism, the podcast that delves deep into the intersection of finance and racial disparities. I'm your host and money EQ specialist, Dr. Joe Burns. I'm here to guide you through a series of thought-provoking conversations with people of color that aim to uncover the intricate relationships between money and systemic racism. Whether you're curious about the subject, seeking insights, or ready to join the fight against systemic injustices, money and racism is your space to learn, discuss, and take action. So, join us every week as we engage in free-flowing conversations that challenge the status quo and encourage critical thinking. Together, we'll work towards a more equitable and just financial world. This week's episode, we have Nia Kiara Cole, who's an agricultural education consultant. Nia's interest in farming began at an early age, spending childhood summers on their grandfather's homestead in North Carolina. Originally from Atlanta, Nia became a part of the DC community in 2011 when they moved to the capital to attend Howard University, receiving a BA in film and later pursuing a master's in social work. Throughout their graduate studies and personal experiences, Nia developed a passion for connecting the Black and Brown communities disproportionately affected by food insecurity and food-related chronic illnesses with fresh, healthy, and organic foods. Nia has always had passion for engaging with communities at risk, previously serving as the program manager for Chop Art, a nonprofit providing arts and wrapped-around services to unhoused children and teens in Atlanta, and volunteering for local Children's Special Olympics, food aid and recovery during the 2020 BLM protests throughout the district, and DC's Feed the People Mutual Aid Group from 2020 to 2022. Eventually, Nia found their way to helping upkeep a few seniors' community garden plots and unearth a deep and ancestral connection with working the land. In the midst of the pandemic, after witnessing the drastic death toll and food shortages, again, most significantly impacting communities of color, Nia applied and was accepted to the Ecoversity as featured on Netflix's Down to Earth and obtaining a certification in permaculture design. And shortly thereafter, switched careers and began working full-time as a trainee, farmhand, and educator for multiple local farms in the DMV, including Common Good City Farm, Three Part Harmony Farm, Moonstone Poultry, Juniper Gardens, and Deep Roots Farm. Nia's long-term goal is to revitalize the old homestead in North Carolina as a community-centered family farm that would serve, educate, and empower Black and Brown communities on and through land and historical reclamation. Please help me welcome Nia Kiara Cole. Nia, thank you so much for being here today. I'm super excited about this conversation. Not one I would have thought before I met you, right? Not one that I would have thought like, oh yeah, this is like on my radar. But then after meeting you and having this conversation, it brought up a lot of childhood memories about farming and land ownership and stuff like that for me. So thanks again for being here. Really can't wait to have this conversation today.
Absolutely. I'm excited to be here. I'm excited to have the opportunity to have this conversation. I don't fully know what to expect, but I think that's part of the fun of it.
Yeah, exactly. It's been interesting doing this podcast because there's been things I've learned about people that I've known for a long time, right, who's been on this show so far, that they're like, oh yeah, and this one thing, I'm like, wait a minute, what, you're doing that too? So it's just fun to have these conversations and talk to people. So one question I have been asking a few people as we start off is, obviously, you know, there's your bio and all the fun stuff that you feel comfortable putting on paper. What else do you want people to know about you, maybe that you didn't include in that, but it's like, hey, you know, this would be cool people knew this about what I do?
I would say one thing that people don't know, especially just because it's so hyper recent, is what happened between April 7th of 2023 through November of 2023. And that was a big part of my journey, especially in regards to land stewardship and where I am now. And that was being displaced, having a lot of issues interpersonally with some of the farmers that I was working with up there that I looked at as mentors, going to North Carolina, living on a homestead, living on a trailer off grid for several months before making it to Georgia. And none of these things I saw happening. If you would have talked to me April 6th, which was my birthday, I would have never been like, yeah, this is what the rest of the year is going to look like. And now at this point, I live on and co-own a farm and house, 10 acres in Georgia.
Oh, that's cool. It's funny how life kind of throws things at us. And we're like, when you start planning, it's like, what's going to happen in a year? You're like, I don't know. Like, we can have ideas, but at the same time, it's like, I don't know, like, what's going to happen. Like you said, your life looks totally different now than how it did just from your birthday last year. I would say hopefully all good, but it sounds like there's some things that weren't so good in that process. But I think where you're at, and it was really cool when you told me that you had just bought this farm and this is like that next iteration of your journey into, you know, like you said, land stewardship, farming, and who knows what 2024 is going to hold for you. But it sounds like it's starting off with a pretty good trajectory for where you're going and what you want to do.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also find it interesting how, given the subject of the conversation today, how much a lot of money things, the issues and the iterations of how those affect Black farmers, young farmers, etc., was a big part of a lot of the hard parts of last year that ultimately led to this moment and even the win at the end of that.
Yeah, and that's one reason why I've mashed these two subjects together, because I think when we look at the different pieces of life, you know, money's involved in all of it, because it's what we exchange to make things happen. As I started my journey into the whole racism in the United States and from a focus on money, there's so many things I've learned and so many things I have yet to learn, but how it's all impacted and influenced by what's our credit like, how much access do we have to money, even the roots of farming and land ownership and how that has to do and connected with the banks. And there's a really crazy history that I don't think we're going to get into too much today, but, you know, just to kind of pique people's interest, like there's a lot of stuff here that we could really get into and talk about. But what I want to focus on mostly is what we've talked about with you, right? Is the farming aspect, the land stewardship and ownership, because I know that's your area of expertise and what you're super passionate about. So you want to tell people a little bit about, maybe start at the beginning, like how you got into this. Did you just wake up one morning and be like, hey, I want to own a farm one day? Or what's the journey for you from like even childhood into adulthood and kind of what's got you to where you're at today?
Of course. It was a lot of random twists and turns, which I have at this age come to admire of not having such a linear journey. So pieces, there were like kind of like little nuggets of it along the way before I finally just like made the leap. One of the first ones being that I'm a fifth generation farmer. So on my father's side, both his father and both of his grandfathers were farmers. I want to say one of them, my grandmother's father, so my great grandfather, actually was a sharecropper. And at that time, it wasn't common for a lot of Black people to make it out of sharecropping. Sharecropping was often kind of like another form of slavery at that point. It's like you're constantly indebted to the plantation owner, to the landowner, which was white. He actually was able to make it out, purchase his land, and purchase several other properties, which was really cool. So I grew up knowing that, going to visit the farm that my dad grew up on, kind of having that in the background, like this love and connection to farming and nature and being outside. Other aspects of it were kind of like, I did a master's in social work, and I started to get language behind food apartheid and food injustice and food swamps and food deserts. And that was really jarring, especially as a person of color who, you know what those things are from living in them or having family members who live in them. You don't know what those things are because someone explicitly tells you that. So being in this master's program where I was very specifically looking at Black and brown spaces and how these things related to that was another iteration of like, oh, okay, food, farming. Just a little nugget, because I have been deeded my grandfather's land, the land that my father grew up on. So when I turn 35, in about 5 years, I'll take that land over entirely. So I've always also kind of had this like time bomb, no, not even time bomb, but just kind of like this timeline of like, by this point, farm things are going to happen. So again, so we're getting, so like I said, I'm at my master's at this point. So older and older I'm getting, the more I'm getting these little nuggets that are piecing together. And then the pandemic happened. And we were seeing the real effects of, again, food deserts, food apartheid, all these things on a much grander scale, because they were no longer hidden in these isolated Black and brown neighborhoods, but they were affecting massive amounts of people to the point where people were going hungry in America. And doing that work, working for the health department, trying to help connect people with food, again, I was so intimately attached to it and attached to the numbers and data about how it affects Black and brown people more than anybody else in this country, how it affects health and all these things from college that I learned about the Black Panthers and their free breakfast program and all of these things kind of culminated to me quitting my job at the beginning of, what was it? I think 2021 maybe, or 2022, and started farming full time. I just kind of like took a deep dive. It's like, well, got nothing to lose. This is clearly a problem. I've been thinking about this for a while. Let's just see what happens.
Yeah, it's crazy. And there's so much you said in that piece. I'm like, oh, where do we want to go, right? There's so many things we can talk about, so many pieces, because it's such a large subject and such a needed subject. I think one thing that I think stands out to me, a lot of people don't realize that. They're just like, they're brought up in life as you just go to the grocery store and buy food. My roots is when I was growing up, we were fortunate enough to have a plot of land next to my grandmother's house that we planted every summer. So my upbringing was not going to the store and buying vegetables. It was going out into our garden and picking them in the middle of the summer if I was hungry. We've really separated, hey, how do we get food with growing it on the land to, oh, we just go to a place and buy it. And then if it's there, we can get it. If it's not, then we can't. And I think there's a real disconnect there, you know, like you're saying, with the availability of having food. And I know when we first talked and I first listened to you speak, some things that I didn't have language around either were all the things that you mentioned. And some people may pick that up about food deserts, food swamps. Like, I'm like, what are these things? Like, I just know that there's food out there and I just go to the place where I want, right? Again, showing my white privilege of being like, I just go to where I want and there was food and I just go buy it and I'm happy. And it's like, do I want fast food today? Do I want a restaurant? Do I want to go to the grocery store so I can cook myself? There's all these things. But when you actually put language around it, I thought that was really fascinating. Maybe we can talk about that for a second. Like the language around what actually happens with farm to table, I would say, you know, where it starts to the availability people have. It's just interesting. I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about these different pieces and what do they mean? You know, if someone were to say, hey, Nia, you said this food desert thing. What does that mean? Like if we're living in a desert, does that mean there's no food? This is the way my brain would work. I'm like, I don't understand what this concept is. So what is this concept?
Of course. I'd love to elaborate. So I'll start with food deserts and food swamps, and we'll kind of go up there. Food deserts are the concept that basically there are no grocery stores within a certain mile radius to you. And that includes walking mile radius and transportation radius as well, meaning driving and or public transportation. Food deserts are obviously the idea that there are some places that literally don't have any grocery stores within that radius of them that would be considered accessible and easily accessible. Food swamps are then take a food desert, right? So you have the space of a food desert. There's no available easy access food like grocery store. Food swamp is that plus the easily accessible food options are fast food options. And there are a plethora of them. Now, the reason I said I'll start there and go to things like food apartheid is because a lot of people of color, and I would say our white allies that are also starting to do this work and have these conversations and do this research and this acknowledgement, recognize that a desert and a swamp, right, are natural ecosystems. When we say these words, they naturally occur out in nature, as in like there are literally plants and animals that are adapted to be in these conditions because they naturally occur. Now, yes, humans can intervene and create them, but for the most part, they're actually natural ecosystems. We try to go away from that language and go into language that uses words like apartheid instead of desert to acknowledge that a lot of these things are intentional. Just like when we talk about gentrification and how a lot of that happens from intentional disinvestment in these communities so that they can depreciate in value, et cetera, et cetera. The same thing happens when you're talking about food access. I've even researched when I was living in DC and all the work that I was doing, we had a bunch of data over the course of years of just the breakdown of the wards and the number of grocery stores in them over the course of years. There were more grocery stores in a poor Black neighborhood one year than the next year because they left because there weren't enough people to be able to sustain the buying. Right? Because they're mostly impoverished Black and brown neighborhoods, because that's usually one of the highlights of these spaces that are suffering from food apartheid is there are usually also very limited transportation options. There's usually also very, very low income levels on top of the fact that they are almost exclusively Black and brown.
Yeah. And it's interesting you bring up that because I follow the news. When we first talked, one of my questions for you was like, so what about these big box stores that are saying, oh, you know, we're pulling out because of blah, blah, blah reason, which for people listening to this podcast, you already know, like the system's rigged. It really is rigged. We can't have conversations like this without that basic level of understanding that the system itself is racist. And so then we have to fight against the system. Well, what about like Walmart and Target, you know, saying, hey, you know, in some of these cities, they're pulling out because their stores are for whatever stupid reason they gave. And I'm going to use that intentionally. Like they gave some really dumb reasons why they wanted to close some of their stores. And it started making sense to me. Oh, they're not seeing them as profitable. And they're finding some other reason so that they can pull their stores from these areas and create these food deserts, right? Where they can't get there. And then data later came out that said that the numbers they were using were actually not correct. a decimal point was in the wrong place. So they're talking about like retail theft and stuff like that. And that's one reason they were using like, oh, because our stores are being stolen from and it's not helpful for us. But then going back to you just talking about like how the data supports things, the data can be very good in a lot of ways to help us understand, hey, what are these ecosystems and what do they look like? And I think what's important too is when we don't scrutinize the data, it can be used to the detriment of the people that's trying to support and serve. So I just want to call that out because I thought that was very interesting. Kind of the evolution of like, you know, looking at these things and now that's on my radar from talking to you to be like, oh, hey, wait a minute, I can see what these retailers are doing. It's not, oh, hey, look, we have a problem here. They're very intentional about what they're doing. So it's just something I wanted to call out because if we don't call it out, then it continues to be a problem. And people are like, hey, why is this a problem? Well, it's because the system itself is being intentional about pulling these resources out of these communities that really need the resources. If you don't live in an area where you can get easy access to food, then what happens? Then that's another burden on your survival for what you need to actually get there, if that all makes sense. I love this conversation, as you can tell, because I'm like, oh, as me in my whiteness, right? And then to get to call that out. This summer, our car broke down. Well, I have a Walmart that's a half a mile from my house. So I'm just like, I'll just walk down there. I'm not going to walk down there in the middle of the afternoon because it's Las Vegas and it's like 115, but I'm just going to walk down there. But what happens if that Walmart was a mile or 2 miles away from my house? Oh, then I would just Uber down there, Uber Eats or something, or like Instacart it to my house. But if you don't have those resources, right? If you don't have resources or even a car to begin with, let's even go there, and there's no public transportation to take you there, then how do you get fed, right? It becomes a burden upon you actually being able to sustain your life, which is problematic.
Yeah. And or you end up a lot of times going to the options that are the easiest and the most accessible, which are usually the most unhealthy in those neighborhoods and in those communities, which often leads to much higher rates of things like food-related diseases, those things like high blood pressure, diabetes, heart disease, all of those things. You see a much higher number of those as well in these communities. And then obviously higher mortality, that's a big part of it, in addition to how some of those things relate back to crime and even education performance and then your trajectory after that. Like, I'm grateful that I was doing a master's in social work at the time we were placed in these lower income, largely Black and brown wards and neighborhoods at schools. And we had a group, and I remember talking to a young man with a father, and he was just telling me about his story. And he was like, yeah, I've been to jail several times. And the reason being is because I started stealing when I was a kid. But he started stealing because his mom was already working 2+ jobs to support all of the kids, and they were still hungry and the lights weren't on. And he, being a child, didn't know what else to do. And that's a part of also what you see in your neighborhood. So he did that. But that was his introduction to crime, was being hungry and knowing that his mom needed support and there was nowhere for it to come. So he just tried to solve the problem himself. So that to me is why you see all these layers of all these things in these neighborhoods. And a lot of it sometimes can tie back to food, which is a part of why the Black Panther even started the free breakfast program, because of recognizing just how much of a difference it makes the child having access to food, having access to a meal, and their ability to perform in school, to access just a different life and be their best selves by being able to just have food in them. And so much so, right, that it was adopted by even the United States. If you see it in most public schools, there's a free breakfast.
I was just going to ask that, right? Because a lot of people don't realize that. They're like, well, the government does that now. They must have taken it from the government. Rarely does the government ever like that forward thinking.
Yeah, no, that was definitely, I want to say if you do enough research, you'll find that that was definitely something that was started by the Black Panther program and then adopted.
Isn't it so interesting? I know a lot of ingenuity and innovation is born out of frustrated people who see a problem that isn't being taken care of.
I would say even more so, especially in the person of color, it's not even necessarily frustrated. How do I say it? Just a problem. It's not a need. It's not just a problem. It's a need.
Yeah.
Like, I want to hyper-emphasize that, because even my family's story of being farmers, and even historically some of the most progressive things that have happened in farming that are even adopted and utilized by a lot of white farmers today, are things that were born from the necessity of, we are Black and brown. Nobody else is going to feed us. We are not allowed to own land. We are not allowed to be in these spaces. We are not allowed to have access. So we have to figure out a way to take care of ourselves.
Yeah, that survival instinct kicks in and being like, well, if there's nobody else and it's just us, what do we have to do? And it's unfortunate that it's been like that. Like, that's one thing I want to call out, right? It's super unfortunate. But again, like you said, when there's nobody else there, then you have to do something. Us as humans, survival is what we'll go to every time. A good human trait, but it's, to me, looking at that, it's sad that the systems in place don't allow us to see human beings, but they continue to see race and color as the barrier and be like, well, we can't do that for them because it's not affecting us. They don't look like us. So why would we? It's super frustrating to me. It makes zero sense. It's that those old pieces of how things were set up that continue to linger today. The systemic racism that exists that is still prevalent from 400 years ago. It just looks a little different today.
Yeah. In addition to, I feel like there's a hyper-emphasis a lot of times on only blaming the symptoms rather than addressing the causes, right? Like the symptom of crime rather than addressing the actual like cause, what leads people to commit crimes, right?
Yeah. Like, oh, we're just going to take care of the crime, but why is it a problem to begin with? Oh, the families are hungry, so now they're stealing food so they can survive. Well, why don't we take care of that problem instead, right?
Or even like Freakonomics, one of my favorite books, they reference Roe v. Wade, oddly enough, given the time that we are currently in. But they remember that there was this projection that there was going to be such a massive increase in crime at the time back in the 90s. And there wasn't. There was a decrease. And what Freakonomics goes into in the book is how that decrease can be considerably linked to Roe v. Wade being passed and there not being increased crime over the next several years because of the fact that there were not children constantly entering the system or their families or spaces where they couldn't be provided for and then were finding their ways into crime, or even families that were finding their way into those spaces for the same reason, trying to provide for their children, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, I remember seeing that segment. I like Freakonomics. I listen to his podcast every once in a while. It's fun. But it's true, right? We look at that and it's like, can we solve for what's the root cause? You know, I spent 25 years in IT in the corporate space, right? And that's what every time there's a problem, what's the root cause? Why did this happen? And for societal problems, we don't necessarily tend to look at it that way. Like, we're like, what's that pressure point that's causing us pain right in the second? We never go back and say, what's really causing this to happen? And then what solution can we have? What's the thing we can go back later and say, okay, why did this happen? Yes, we know now. Why now? How can we solve this so it doesn't continue to be a problem? And that's, again, a frustrating thing of society for me as well. I'm like, listen, there's things we can do if we just take the time to understand it and study it. Or again, the systems itself, which leads me back to one piece I really want to talk to you about is the sharecropping piece. If people haven't done their research on history, go back and research sharecropping and on the surface what it looked like and then underneath what it was really about. Because like you mentioned, like rarely did any sharecroppers ever get to the point where they could buy their land out. The promise was there, but the reality wasn't one that really made it possible for them to actually get ahead right through that process. But your family did, which is very interesting to me.
Yeah. I would say a lot of people would be surprised to know that families were sharecropping up until, I believe, the 60s. Even like there were some families that were still not in a position to be able to get out of it, that generationally they were still farming up the 60s. I don't always know how or why certain people were able to. I think sometimes it was interpersonal relationships with people. Sometimes, unfortunately, the remnants of slavery, that particular great-grandfather that made it out of sharecropping was a product of not a consensual relationship, we'll say, with his mother's slave owner. So I think sometimes those dynamics played a part in it as well. I even have access to some of the documents that show when some of my ancestors were given rather than sold because they were the illegitimate children of that particular slave owner. And so being able to stay in a community where you are somewhat linked to these white farm owners and landowners through either literal lineage or just from being in the community for so long because you were able to stay rather than constantly displaced like so many other people, sometimes played a part in why some were able to make that out of those situations versus others. And that's a part of our family history.
I think it's fascinating. Did you have that data? I have talked to some people who don't have that data, right? Data was lost or wasn't well tracked or any of that. which is interesting to me, right? Because again, the system itself is trying to destroy any links to the past. We have a hard time talking about what happened in the past. That's why American history, these pieces have been whitewashed so much, right? Nobody talks about them. You got to really dig to find out what really happened. And one thing that I want to bring up for people, like when I think of sharecropping before we've had our conversations, I thought sharecropping was a thing of like the post-Civil War for a few years, and then they figured it didn't work. And so then it just kind of went away. Like, you know, I haven't done extensive history on it or research in history on it. But for you to say, you know, like it still existed well into the 60s just kind of blows my mind that it was still a thing. I mean, that's a long time for that to go. That's like 100 years. You know, the white system being able to benefit from this, I think you said it, and if not, I'll say it, right? This kind of secondary form of slavery, there was no way out of it. I guess nowadays you could maybe say like student loans or like that next iteration of that, right? Where you just can't ever get ahead. Like the system itself will not allow you to get ahead. It's just near impossible. Not impossible, but near impossible, right? Because there's like people like with your family who have shown that, hey, we were able to get ownership of land.
But weren't able to keep it on that particular family side.
Oh, they weren't? So they got it, but they couldn't keep it?
Yeah, no. I mean, because that's another layer of how money played a part in talking about land ownership and the transition of it is a lot of Black farmers that were able to get land, either through sharecropping or purchasing it or whatever happened, were often not able to keep it, especially once you get to, I would say, not even the 60s, but through post-slavery up through even the 90s and even still today with predatory lending practices of discrimination by the FSA, by the USDA, by these people that had access to resources, had access to loans and all these things and not being able to secure what you needed to keep your land. You lost it. Also not having access to education and different things. My grandfather had an eighth grade education, and not to say he was not extremely smart, but he had an eighth grade education. That's important when you think about the fact that my uncle and my father were the ones that went to Howard and then came back and helped him write the deed that now is the reason that I own my family's land. There are a lot of people that have a lot of people of color, especially that have a lot of issues with heiress property, which is why there are whole organizations dedicated to helping Black and brown people with heiress property and navigating through that, especially when you don't have the proper legal documents in place. So there were so many different things that could impact someone, not just being able to make it out of a sharecropping, but then if you did, being able to continue to keep it.
That's crazy. What you're saying, Nia, is that if they got through the sharecropping thing, then it was still wasn't like the promised land of land ownership. So now they become esteemed members of society that were on the equal level as everybody else.
No, not necessarily. A lot of times it was then a race to now figure out how to keep it.
Yeah.
Because again, going back to what I was saying about the necessity part is that my grandfather wasn't a farmer by profession. He was a homesteader, if you want to be technical about it. He wasn't necessarily generating sustainable income. There were some things he was definitely doing off the farm to generate income, but he always had to have another job. It was a sustenance to be able to provide for his family. Being able to send them to Howard was partially possible because he had to sell part of our family land. But these things that he was doing were out of a need to be able to maintain it. And so having that pressure and then simultaneously having the pressure of having to compete in an industrialized market, you also had a lot of Black and brown people not be able to, again, make a profit off of their land and be just homesteaders. And that sometimes was another part, an extension of eventually losing the land if you're talking about, again, especially heirs property or et cetera. And or when we're talking about the barriers and how money and all these things affects it, is again, not being able to utilize your land to generate large income to sustain it and keep it, et cetera, what might lead you to the FSA. And then we go back to what I was just talking about. It's like all these little nuggets of how Black and brown people were affected by this. And so having access to land wasn't always just like this, woo, we did it. It was, we did it. Now, how do we keep it?
Yeah. And I think that's important for people to understand because it isn't just like, oh, hey, we got the land, so now everything's blue skies and roses. There's a lot to it, right? And there's a lot of laws out there, like you were saying, that if you're really running a farm and just not a homesteader, how do you get funding for it? If it's a full-time business for you, right, you have to be able to have the machinery you need. You have to have the supplies. You have to have that stuff. And if you don't have access or easy access to those funds or funding, then that makes it really hard. Not to mention, There's one law that everybody always complains about, and I don't know it very well, but I know that if you have a business in America and you show a loss for so many years in a row, the IRS are just going to come in and say, hey, guess what? You guys just have a hobby. So good luck with that. It's no longer a business. It's just a hobby. And we're going to like declassify you in this conversation. Right? That's also a problem because I know in farming, it's really hard to show a profit to begin with.
Yeah.
Because there are a lot of expenses and the profit margins are really, really narrow. I hope people understand this. Like there's a lot of, like you keep saying, there's these little nuggets. There's these a lot of different pieces that play into what happens, right? And again, the system is not set up to help support or help you win in this process. The system is set up to punish, especially the black and brown people, over and over and over to where, I mean, a lot of them probably just want to give up, right? Or have to, like you're saying, they just lose it because they can't sustain the ownership any longer.
Yeah. You still have people. There was a very big case in the 90s, the Pickford case, that partially referencing of a lot of black and brown farmers who ended up losing their land because of the discrimination by the USDA and FSA. They won that lawsuit. It was actually one of the largest lawsuits that they won at the time. And there were people as of March 2023 who still hadn't gotten paid, who had lost their land. People who were a part of the original case who had passed and their grandchildren were there representing them because it had been going on for so long. I mean, even some of my friends, you know, and the people I know personally, how do I explain it? Sometimes it's not just being able to access the resources. Then it's also the area that you're in. I know some black and brown farmers who are currently fighting for their land because their white neighbors are harassing them, calling the police on them, getting them arrested, that form of discrimination and racism. You have still, again, these access and barriers to being able to get loans. Even our process was so difficult when you compare it to the people that we bought the farm from where I currently live now. And when you compare their story and how they just applied through, again, this particular bureau in Georgia and was able to get the loan to get the house versus what we had to do and all the hoops we were jumping through trying to get this loan. And then that fell through, having to have this meeting with this friend and then ultimately going through like a land trust and then getting connected to a reparations trust. We were actually given money, redistributed money to black and brown people, but just the levels to which we had to constantly go and the challenges that we faced were so much more than what our counterparts had to go through. And so there's still so many barriers to black and brown people getting access to land, especially when we're talking about land stewardship. And that's especially young black and brown farmers. There's not any more of it. There are a few reparations projects that are popping up where white landowners are starting to give land back. But as of 2021, I believe there were statistics that reported land ownership in the U.S. still being 98% white.
I believe that. And that's the thing that I really want to call out. If anybody listens to this episode and they're just like, what's one thing? Is that the white experience is not the black and brown experience. And so for white people to say, well, it's just really easy, just like we were able to do it, just super easy. Yeah, we had to, it was hard for us because we had to save money or blah, blah, blah. Like that's one step. I've just owned homes, right? My process has been actually pretty easy. Even in times when I'm like, I don't know, some things are kind of questionable, you know, things are kind of tight and I was still approved. I want white people to really understand like the white experience when it comes to land ownership, home ownership, any of these funding processes where you got to go to the bank or go to somebody to lend money from, your process, your worldview is going to be very different than people of color, 100% every single time. I mean, there's plenty of data out there. If you just go Google, you can find it. We don't got to sit here and talk about all the data points, but it really is that process. So you being able to get this farm where you're at now is actually a pretty big win for you.
It very much so is. It was only because of philanthropic dollars and because we were connected with a trust fund, equity trust fund, that supported us with a low interest loan. And they are trying to do this kind of work of supporting black and brown folks and folks that don't have access to these resources through providing these low interest loans so that we can start to do these kind of projects. And they support collective land ownership and collective action, et cetera, et cetera. So being able to have access to those kind of resources were amazing. But these are definitely things that have come about within the last several years, being able to know the right people to be connected to a resource like that. And the fact that like we very genuinely, it's funny that you mentioned the bank. We did try to go through the bank. We got denied multiple times. Going through them actually hit some of our credit and kind of messed things up for us really bad, being able to go to another bank after that point. A lot of misinformation on their part. We had horrible time with the bank and had to go through this route. So it's funny that you mentioned that, because that was very much so a reality for us. It was not easy.
Yeah. It's funny you bring that up. Lots of little side tangents here, but this is the experience, and this is what I really want to capture, because it hasn't been easy for you, and you've still gotten what I would say is probably one of your dreams, right? To own a farm, to be able to work a farm. But it is, the process isn't, like you just said, you know, if you went to a bank, you're like, that's what we should do, right? That's what we've been indoctrinated to believe. All the banks are going to loan us money. We need money for large purchases. So they go there, whatever process they're using, right? You apply, it hits your credit now because there's an inquiry. And so then it's like, oh, well, if you want to get back at the same point where you were before you did that, even being denied, you got to wait like months to even years to get that repaired, right? Because just that one inquiry is like, oh, that's bad. So the process just isn't set up for people who are trying to do it through the process, I would say the right way in air quotes, right? And not knowing that these other resources exist out there, or that you even had to use these other methods to get it. Who would have thought, like in the beginning, you're like, oh no, guys, we can't go to the bank because they're not going to loan to us. So we got to go through these other four organizations over here, and then we'll be able to actually get the land that we want to purchase. Where if like a white dude just walks into the bank and they're like, yeah, sure, we'll loan to you. That's great. Let's go. And so that's a part of that process I really want to capture, because I know it's been a journey for you. And then it actually happened, which is amazing. But again, want to call out the process in which you had to go through was not a conventional process, as people would look at it as a conventional process, right? But it put myself out there a little bit to say that the people of color, the black and brown communities, this is probably the, I would put air quotes again, the normal process they usually have to go through for something like this, right? Not the non-conventional way, because the conventional way is meaning it's for everybody. It's the white way that people usually get through. I don't know, that's my thoughts and what I've seen, but you may have different thoughts there.
I mean, I would say they are definitely black and brown folks that go through the conventional way, but there are still barriers to them. Like, I'll give you another example that actually ties into my story going back to the beginning when you asked me about getting here. How I mentioned being displaced. I was working at a black woman-owned farm in the DMV that I had been working at for a while. You know, I looked at this person as my mentor. They had taught me so much, and they had gotten this really large, great loan from the USDA to purchase their 50-acre property. But immediately they were faced with the fact that they had to pay this loan back. And so they had to get the farm production ready, and it had a lot of needs. And so there was a lot of stress on this person that I think ultimately kind of turned them into someone who, how do I explain this? This person was being given money from programs to be a mentor farmer. But because of the pressures on her to have to get her farm at production ready, at market ready, to be able to hyper produce to pay this loan back, she really wasn't able to focus on providing mentorship and training to black and brown farmers. And that's what a lot of us need. A lot of us did not, again, grow up with having easy access to our farming lineage or past, or didn't even know this was an option to be able to pursue sometimes when you're talking about pursuing careers and training. So a lot of us are interested and want to do this work, but we need mentorship, we need training, we need all these things. She could not really provide that, which ultimately then led to her losing a lot of workers, all these things, and even putting me off because of all the stress she was under. So do you see how that also then ties into some of these things again, is that even when you do go through the conventional route, you still have a lot of barriers and a lot of pressure up against you. And it's kind of like the walls are constantly closing in. And unless you have a crap ton of support, because that's a big part of how black and brown people have been able to survive and continue to, is our networks, being able to be connected to people with resources. Sometimes those are white organizations that are redistributing funds. Sometimes those are white allies just passing us off to somebody else, saying a good word, et cetera, et cetera. And a lot of times it's our own networks holding each other and constantly creating this very large net to be able to create a foundation. But again, that foundation is supporting a lot of folks. So sometimes it's also overwhelmed and can't extend to every single black and brown person who needs it. And so then you kind of get these cracks in the foundation.
I think that's important to call, because your communities are holding a lot of weight that isn't your responsibility. But again, back to survival piece, it's been what's been created out of necessity, right? We were saying earlier, right?
Yeah. Like I said, like, we have no other choice. Nobody else is going to do it. So we have to.
Yeah. I want to call out white people on this. This is why we have to get involved, because we have resources, we have connections. And if we can help ease the burden, then everybody can grow together, right? It can be less about race and more about humanity, which is what I'm all about. But I know everybody's not about that. So we got to work on this one at a time. And that's the other thing I want to call out too, is there's no simple fix for any of these problems, right? Because there's complex social problems. There's some simple ways we can start to do it, which is white people can be less stupid and start like actually looking at this stuff and being like, hey, this is a problem. How can we be involved? I think that's a simple enough solution for people to start. It's not going to solve the problem overnight.
No.
But we can start to be involved in the process to be like, what resources do I have that can ease the burden of these particular people? Whatever passion you have. I mean, we're talking about farming and land ownership right now. There's whatever passion you have to get involved, because there's a lot of need and a lot of involvement that can happen that's just not happening today, which is unfortunate.
And I think there are lots of tiers of ways that people can support, because sometimes it looks like giving a donation to the organization that I mentioned that made me being able to be here possible, Equity Trust Fund. You know, there are definitely other organizations like them, things like Pot Liquor and all of these spaces, Just Flow Fund, that are doing this work, so supporting it through donations, right? Sometimes it's the physical support of, I worked on a farm that was owned by a Black woman in DC. We had a lot of white volunteers there, because what she would do is she had like a work share program. So instead of like paying for a CSA share, you could come and volunteer your physical labor there. And even on some of the other Black and Brown farms I've worked on, we've had folks come and volunteer of all different races, but especially when we're talking about white folks, is to me, it's figuring out if you can either give the monetary and financial resources. Sometimes the other very physical resource, like sometimes it's making a donation to a Black farm that you know needs a tractor. You're like, okay, we'll buy it. Or I have a friend who has one and connecting you to that resource and using your network in that way. But sometimes it's also showing up and doing that physical labor. Sometimes that means a lot, because also when we're talking about farming, is this is hard. I definitely need bodies out in the field. You know, some carrots not going to pull themselves.
I'm glad you brought that up, because a lot of times we think, oh, well, you know, who do I donate to? I can donate money. But you can have a bunch of money and that's not going to solve, like you're just saying, that's not going to pick the carrots. Like the money's not going to walk out there and pick the carrots. Yeah, you can hire people. But again, there are other ways to donate, other resources, I should say, you can donate, right? Besides just money, there's time, there's energy, there's, like you say, your connections. There's very specific things that, like, hey, your money could go to getting a tractor. Maybe you know somebody who has a tractor that they want to get rid of it or something, right? These connections are super important in the world as a whole. And when we can start thinking outside the box like that and really look at what the necessities and the needs are from the people who need the help, I would say the first step of that is getting to know them, to understand them, to come and say, hey, you know, Nia, I'd like you, I've talked to you a few times. What do you need? What help can I do, without being like, oh, here's just some money, go figure it out yourself. I would imagine, like back to the example of this lady you were talking about, that can be kind of overwhelming when you have to be the one to figure out, oh, here are all the needs for everything I have. And now what do I do with all that? I don't know, just some random thoughts of conversations I've had with my wife about other stuff, but I think kind of applies here, right? That kind of emotional side of like having to hold all that can be very overwhelming at times as well, right?
Absolutely. I think that we, having to do the labor of constantly educating, being aware, and et cetera, can be a lot. And it can be super helpful to have folks be able to be present in that way, to show up in that extra way, rather than putting the burden on the Black and Brown person to figure out how you can show up. For me, it's just, like you said, taking the time to sit down and observe, get to know where there are places that you could support.
Yeah, I think that's important.
In addition to asking, but sometimes asking can be another form of labor, because now I have to figure out, okay, well, how can you support me? And then what do I do with it? And et cetera, et cetera. Sometimes it's like figuring out where the spaces are, doing that research in your own time, in your own space, finding safe spaces to ask someone questions and people who have capacity to do that. And then figuring out how you can show up sometimes makes a huge difference.
Yeah, because you're just like, I don't know, I just need to not feel so stressed. So can't you just figure something out, right?
Exactly.
It's like, there's so exactly. much going on.
Because like you said, yeah, so going back to just giving donations is great. And the idea of hiring someone is awesome. But when we're thinking about it, right, like farm workers already don't make a lot of money. So giving donations is cool. But is that really enough to sustain somebody's salary? Like all these things, like it, sometimes it's just easier for you to like, you got 5 hours on a Wednesday. Maybe two of those can be donated to a farm.
Yeah, just show up and come, like, just do what I tell you to do, and that'll be good, right?
Right. Because also, a lot of times, we're not unreasonable. Now, we're not going to expect you, like, yes, go lift that 100-pound bag of feed, when I know that you probably have barely even picked up a garden spade in the last 2 months. Like, no, we're not unreasonable. But I do think sometimes people overvalue donations and monetary support for Black and brown folks rather than physical labor.
Yeah.
And a need and a necessity for that kind of support that we need in our spaces.
Kind of back to what I said, is that because then you have to get to know the people, right? You just can't like just randomly donate and be like, well, I feel better now about myself now. It requires more effort on white people's parts to be like, hey, I'm going to go show up. I'm going to get to know, in this case, these farmers. I'm going to go help them. I'm going to be involved in the process, right? It creates that connection. And it requires, I would say, from a resource perspective of people, it requires more. They're not willing to invest that much into making it happen. So I'm going to encourage everybody to maybe this next year, don't donate money, but go donate your time. Right? Find Black or brown owned farm and go like donate your time. Show up and be like, hey, how can I help you? I have 2 hours on a Saturday once a month. I can come help you or something. Like, think outside the box, because I think that will be more impactful than just say, hey, you know, here's a couple $100 and do with it what you need.
Absolutely. It's a hyper emphasis on taking the time to get to know folks so you can figure out some of those intimate ways that you can show up that can sometimes be hard for us to have to sit down and articulate and figure out when there's so many other things that we're trying to,
yeah,
to juggle.
Yeah, 100%. I'm with you on that. Got my brain thinking about like, hey, how can I help out in different ways? Which is good for me, right? I always like to push myself to be like, huh, how can I not do it the conventional or easy way, right? How can I actually be involved in what's going on? And Nia, this conversation has been so good. I don't know if it's what you want to talk about, but it's been good to kind of give people, I think, an idea of, you know, what some of the plights are, what some of the issues might be around farming. Before we close up, though, I want to ask you one more question. I think that kind of empowering question, but like, you know, help people see what the future is. What do you see? So what would happen from your perspective if there were more younger people that are getting land and can start farming? And what would that do for our food supply, for the food chain, for society in general?
I have a lot to say. I'll try and keep it together. I think one of the things that our elders did for us, and I mean elders as in folks that have been farming longer than us, and that can even include folks that are early 40s even, to some young farmers. A lot of us are in that 30-20 range when we're talking about young farmers that are just entering into this work and wanting to do it, or are very new to it within that 5 to 10 year range. They paved the way for being able to be in these spaces. But I think the difference between young farmers and our older generational farmers, including folks in their 40s and up through even older than that, was the hyper focus on needing it to be production, production, production. Because at the end of the day, I'm just trying to pay bills. I think a lot of young farmers now are recognizing that that form of farming sometimes doesn't allow accessibility to the folks that need it.
Yeah.
If that makes sense, right? That there's still sometimes this disconnect from, okay, you have the Black farmer who's growing the food, but it's still not getting to the Black neighborhoods that are suffering from food apartheid.
Yeah. So it's not solving the problem, right? That the reason why you're trying to do what you're doing. Yeah. I see that.
Exactly. And I think that's a part of how we're trying to approach it is in that way. We are also trying to approach it in a way that is very intentional about reconnecting Black and brown people to land and healing trauma. I could never really explain to a white person the kind of generational trauma you feel from having something that you loved and were amazing at. Because I think a lot of people, white people might not know or just acknowledge that Black and brown people were targeted because we were amazing at agriculture. They saw what we did in Africa and they took us and they forced us to do it here. And so having your relationship with the land that nourishes you and is such a big part of your culture and identity be bastardized in that way, for lack of a better term, leaves so many scars. Scars that are felt, like I said, to children now that are born and see having their hands in the dirt being slave work.
Yeah.
So a lot of us are also doing that as well. How do we heal our people on the land so that we can get them back here? Because it was such a big part of who we were, but there was also a necessity between us interacting with the land, and the land needs it. Like, I think I referenced that one of the talks that you were at is this birth story in Brave Feeds, yeah, where they did research and basically found that no matter how indigenous groups interacted with sweetgrass, sweetgrass always did better when native people interacted with it and harvested it for ancestral practices, whatever they were doing with it, versus just leaving it entirely alone in an unbothered, uncontrolled ecosystem. The land needs Black and brown people to interact with it. We need it as well. That is a big part of what young people in these spaces are trying to do, is heal and get food to the people that need it and provide safe spaces for us all to learn and reclaim a big part of our culture, our ancestry, our heritage, and our future.
I love that. We could talk all day about just that piece. People who follow me or know, like, my coaching business, I talk about money and trauma, right? But the trauma piece, and I think that's so important to call out there, that there is a connection with the land, and having it stripped or pulled away from you, right, creates a lot of trauma, and that trauma lasts. It's an interesting topic to talk about, because now scientifically they're proving, right, that it goes so many generations from when trauma happened, it just gets passed on. So to kind of look at your worldview and, like, hey, if we can get more Black and brown farmers touching the land, look at the healing that will do. From a societal perspective, like, how much healing can happen and the impact that that will have. The first time you talked about this, and even now, right, in my being, I just feel this, like, really juicy, yummy future if it can happen, right, which is really cool. But we got to make it accessible. We have to make it so that it's possible. And currently, the systems don't make it very possible, right? They make it more impossible, and all that pressure to do. Because I like, that's part of it too, as we close out here. That's not going to be helpful, is, like, we give it to you, right? And we make it accessible, but we're going to put so much pressure on you that you can't partake in that farming ritual, right? You can't participate in that ritualistic or ancestral part of that, because when you go to bed every night, you have to think of, hey, am I going to make enough money to keep this land that I worked so hard to get?
Exactly.
Right. Thanks. And that becomes a big problem.
And it even, I think, strips the way that we interact, or not maybe strips, but changes the way sometimes that we interact with it. Because I would say that's another, to me, highlight of what young farmers are trying to do, is very much so approach farming with way more of a holistic, traditional permaculture. You know, there are all these words for an indigenous way of interacting with it. And by doing so, therefore, benefit the entire ecosystem. But a lot of that sometimes requires a lot of resources up front that are not hyper-productive in terms of income immediately.
Yeah.
And so we need that support to be able to transition those spaces into these beautiful ecosystems that ultimately end up generating way, way more income.
Yeah. It gets kind of weird there, right? Nia, this has been an amazing conversation. And this is, like, the tip of the iceberg for the knowledge and, like, just lived experience that you have. I mean, again, for people not listening, or if you didn't pay attention, Nia is not very old. Like, she's done a lot. You're super knowledgeable, and just your passion for this. When I first heard you speak, right, in the other group where you came and spoke to us, just your passion for this. And that's why I'm like, I got to have her on the show, because your passion for this is just, it's so cool. Who would have thought farming? It's that kind of second thought we usually give to, like, oh, we don't even think about where the food comes from, right? But it's just such an integral part of our society, right? Is how do we really, I mean, if you look at it from a business perspective, how do we source food, and where does that food get sourced from, and where does it go, and how do we then get access to that, which is, you know, something, again, we don't think about very often.
I could nerd out on it all day, because to me, there are so many layers to which not knowing where your food comes from is a big part of not being able to have a certain level of control over your body, your health, etc. No matter what race or ethnicity you are, being disconnected from our food in that way, I think, is one of the biggest detriments to us as a society, because I think it's also convinced us that to eat in certain ways, eat certain crops and certain things that ultimately aren't necessarily even beneficial to us or the environment, but more beneficial to a company.
Yep. Yeah, I agree. You know, on that note that you bring that up, right? The resurgence of, I think, when people trying to understand more about themselves, I think there's some of the, you know, these genetic tests you can do now that they'll talk to you about historically, you know, what foods you do better with or what not. I forget which one does that, but one of mine does, like, hey, these foods are probably better for you than these foods because of, you know, our genetics and where we come from. I've had some health problems come up. They started about 10 years ago, but where I were on this food thing, right? And I started having issues with my hands and my skin. And I'm like, what's up with this, right? And go to doctors and try to figure it out. And through happenstance, because I wanted to start eating different, I found out what the problem was. Well, the problem is I have a gluten intolerance. And so it shows up as an autoimmune disease now and attacks my hand. And my skin will peel and I get, like, really bad eczema and all that fun stuff. But again, like you were just talking, so that's why I want to kind of bring it back. It's important to know where our food comes from and what we eat and how we eat it. There's a real connection there. And I think that connection, you know, call it a spiritual connection if you want with the land, whatever your modality of belief is. But there's a lot there that I think that in this capitalistic kind of industrialized world that we live in now, we lose all that.
And then I would say, and then you tie on to me, Black and Brown lends to that is everything you said, plus the intentional distancing us from our culture and our heritage.
Yeah.
Because there are things that we were discouraged from eating, from growing, etc., that are native to this land, that grow as weeds, that have medicinal properties and all this, but we go to a pharmacy, we go to the grocery store to get spinach instead of eating this thing that's basically the equivalent of it that grows in your backyard that ancestrally we used to know, but there wasn't a lot of ways to make profit off of it, so we forgot that and we were distanced from that.
Yeah. And again, I'm going to live and die by this statement I'm going to say next, but I'm going to go for it. I really believe that people who do not like tomatoes have never had one off the vine out of a garden. Just say it. That's super controversial because people will fight me all the time on that. But to have that, right? And that was, again, like I said, we had a small plot of land where, and small, I mean, it was a quarter acre lot. Again, showed my privilege that we planted the entire thing every summer and took care of it. And we had fresh produce. Me and my adult self really yearns for that again. The other side of my adult self doesn't like is the work required to make that happen, right? So it's the convenience in life and busyness of life to get really fresh produce and that. But I think going back, I want to call this out one more time, is just, I remember as a kid, right? We would go and help my parents plant. Like we were always involved in the process. And I know when we were really young, we'd always have to be hosed off outside the house before we could go inside because we'd have mud from head to toe. And I can still feel like it's tactile on my hands, like thinking about this, I can still feel about like playing in the mud, right? And that rich topsoil and just how there's something about that. I'll have to look into that for myself. There's something about that, right? And that connection with the land and where it was. And it was, you know, an area of property that my family's owned for a long time. But that connection, so I can definitely see, you know, when you start talking about that connection to the earth, the connection to land and heritage and ancestry, connecting with the food, right? And the sustainability of life that, you know, helps us maintain life, right? Without food, there's nothing, right? We won't exist.
Right.
Some pontification, I guess, by Joe, as I'm thinking about this, but that's why this conversation has been so interesting to me, because I think there was some small tie of my childhood to what you're really advocating for, and not in large scale at all. Like when we had a quarter acre lot of land we planted vegetables on, looking at the food we had, looking at the accessibility, and not understanding in my own self that it was a super big privilege for us to even have that land to be able to do that, right? That was just my worldview growing up. And then as I got older, I'm like, oh, that's not everybody's worldview. Like not everybody knows how to like plant gardens. I wouldn't say like the veggies might be able to survive, but I would probably remember enough to like, okay, we kind of got to do things like this. And I can Google the rest, at least to make a small garden now.
You know what I mean? Right. It's easier than it looks. Starting it, keeping one, I would say, is where the work is required. But starting it, it can be easier than it's like.
Yeah. So for anybody out there, I've talked about a lot of different things, but just get involved. I think that's the biggest thing. Nia, for you, what do you want to leave people with here at the very end?
Like you were saying, just get involved. Take the time to continue to do these deep dives, continue to research and find this information and find the Black and Brown farmers that need these things, that need these resources, that need these times. And like I said, do research before you ask questions, but also don't be afraid when in safe spaces and in good company to ask questions and to figure out ways that you can show up, whatever you have capacity for. Like, we need it. And it ultimately is healing for everybody.
I like that. And one last call to action I would say is support your local farmer. Find out where they're at. They're everywhere, right? There's farmers everywhere doing something. Go support. Donate some time. Go get to know what it's like to farm. Like you've mentioned many times, it's not easy work, I think, but it's fulfilling work. And it connects you to the land in a way that I don't think any other way can, to be able to nurture it in a way that something actually grows. It's interesting that way. Anyways, Nia, thank you so much for this conversation. I don't know if it felt random as we went through things, but I've really enjoyed this conversation. I know there's a lot more that we could talk about because this subject's not just like an hour's podcast episode worthy. Like there's so much here, so much we can talk about and how farming is affected by both money and racism. And, you know, it's our job as those who are more aware to do something about it and to have a different conversation. But yeah, if people want to get involved in this, what resources would you say, hey, here's the best way to kind of be involved with farming, or here's how we can help support? Like if they're just like, hey, I'm going to Google something, what's some quick Googles they could do?
I would say quick Googles you can do are looking for organizations like the National Black Food and Justice Alliance, looking for organizations like Breeding Seeds, which is an extension of Soul Fire Farm, which has different programs and fellowship programs that they support, even have a reparations map and network that they've been trying to operate, looking up organizations that are similar to Just Flow Fund, Equity Trust Fund, and then looking up, I think there's a Black Farmer Index, actually. I think you can look that up. They started making one of those just so you can find, you know, state by state where some of your local Black and Brown farmers are. And I would say some other quick Googles are the looking up things like Braiding Sweetgrass, looking up books like Farming While Black, looking at things about Black, Brown, Indigenous, Afro-Indigenous, American Indigenous land stewardship, looking at those informations. And so you can have a history of what's happened here, why these things are important, and what that journey and that work looks like now. Those would be some of my goals.
Awesome. Thanks, Nia. Because I know sometimes, you know, people's barrier to entry is like, oh, well, there's so much. But hey, nobody has any excuse now. Nia just gave you like 20 resources you can go Google pretty quick.
I tried to keep people off the top of my head. I was like, oh, dang, I'm not sure. But
those are the best. And I think that's plenty to get people started who really want to go make a difference and get involved. And I hope that you do. So, you know, go do something like that. That's the best advice I can do. Just like go get involved, get doing something. You know, from there, we can start making a difference. So again, Nia, so thankful for you to be here today. Thanks for having this conversation. And I mean, I'm gonna have to have you back at some point. We got like lots more we can talk about, different avenues we can go down that we didn't even get a touch on today. So for those wanting more, make sure to subscribe to the channel and we'll see you next episode. Thanks, everybody. Thanks, Nia.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining us on Money and Racism. We hope we left you with something to think about. If you like the conversation, make sure to subscribe on your favorite podcast platform. And don't forget, please leave a review. To find out more about the psychology and emotion of money, visit www.josephmburns.com. And if you or someone you know would be a great guest for the podcast, email me at podcast@josephmburns.com. Together, we'll work towards a more equitable and just financial world.